Dargrave Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn semester 2009, this is Business Finance FIL 240, Section 6. Lecture 6, delivered on September 3, 2009. The title of this lecture is The Federal Reserve and the Interest Rate Environment.
Today, the Federal Reserve and the interest rate environment. Interest rates are dominating the lectures right now because you will find that interest rates will dominate our thinking in finance in general. In financial management, one of our biggest tasks is to find the value now of projects that we are considering undertaking. Now, if a project really is nothing but a security, a claim on cash flows, then certainly the same parameters that drive any other security will drive the value of a project we are thinking about undertaking. So, if I know that the price of a bond goes down as the interest rate goes up, if I know that the yield on a security goes down as the price goes up, if I know that the price goes down as the yield goes up on any security, then I know for a fact that holding all other things constant, the value of a project that I am considering will go down as interest rates rise. The value of a project will go down as interest rates rise. And therefore, it becomes part of our important understanding to know what interest rates are, to know what the interest rate is that I will use to determine the value of a project. Because as interest rates rise, the value of my projects will fall, simply because if a project is just a security, a claim on future cash flows, future expected cash flows, then I certainly know that the interest rate environment is going to propel, drive, determine the value of that project right now. Interest rates, as I showed you on Tuesday, are comprised a set of premia. Essentially, any interest rate is going to be driven by the interest rate is any interest rate is going to be driven by the risk-free rate plus a default premium plus a maturity premium plus an illiquidity premium. That risk-free rate, R sub F, comprises two components that we can't actually see separately as evident. We can tease them out with econometric models, but they really do exist together as the real interest rate plus the expected inflation premium. At the base of every interest rate is a real interest rate, the opportunity cost of foregone consumption, plus an expected inflation premium. Those together comprise the risk-free rate. And the closest proxy we have to this animal in the real world is the yield on a short-term treasury instrument. A short-term T-bill. That is our proxy. That's the one we'll use in this class as time goes on. So if I want to know about the interest rate environment, if I want to know an interest rate that I should use for discounting future expected cash flows in financial analysis, which we will do a lot of in this class, I should be interested in the yield on a short-term T-bill. I should be interested in what it is and what is driving it. And that's why, as business people, you'll get into a pattern and a routine of looking at financial stuff. In a sense, it's kind of boring to do it, but you'll get into this thing where, well, I'm going to look at stock market data. I'm going to have a look at what this business publication has got online today, what that business newspaper has to say today. You'll get into a sort of a routine of checking out these kinds of business details. You'll know that you're getting to be a boring person when you actually look forward to doing that every morning. That'll be the highlight of your day. But you'll get into that kind of habit. Now, the amateurs will whip open their Wall Street Journal. Yep, stocks went up yesterday. Or they'll go to Google Finance. Oh, there we go. My stock portfolio is doing pretty well. But the world citizen, the global business person, the you that I want you to be, will know what to look for that is deeper. What did the Federal Reserve do today? What signals were coming out of the Congressional Budget Office about projected budget deficits? What's the probability that this bill that is affecting the regulatory environment of businesses that I care about, what are the prospects of this bill passing? Those are the deep subjects that we care about as global citizens of the business world. So, in that vein, I must talk about the Federal Reserve as a prime determinant of the interest rate environment in the short run. Look, the Federal Reserve System was established by the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. What was 1913? We commonly refer to this as the Fed. The Fed is the central bank of the United States. Now, the Federal Reserve System comprises 12 districts. They get bigger as you go west because when this was established, there were fewer people out west than there were in the east. So you have very small districts as you go east, very big districts as you go west. Unfortunately, that's the demographics and the population distribution has changed dramatically. And so you've got these ginormous Federal Reserve districts out in the far west that are handling huge amounts of activity now, comparatively speaking, compared to what they would have, say, 60, 70 years ago. But there are 12 districts. Each district has a Federal Reserve Bank, a district bank. You'll hear me call it a reserve bank or a district bank. And there could be some branches of that bank also in the district as well. Now, each district, its reserve bank will oversee all of the banks, member banks of the Federal Reserve System in that district. So, for example, right here, we are actually on a boundary between two districts. To the north of us is Chicago. To the south of us is St. Louis. And we, do you know which one we're in? Which one governs us? I'm just curious. Were you told this in your economics class? Must keep my podcast clean. That's okay. We're Chicago. Very close, though, to the board. Technically, look, I love this St. Louis Bank. They've got a lot of educational stuff down there. You can go down there. They've got tours that you can do down there. They'll even give you a little bag of shredded money if you want. You get to go up to a window and look in. Now, back in the old days, it was easy. You could go in there and they do these really nice tours. You could get to see a lot more. Nowadays, it's like they've got armed guards everywhere and security cameras and all that. But every bank, and I'm going to show you some dollar bills, every bank acts as an agent for the Treasury to print money. And if you look, you see, and I'm sure most of you have probably seen this. See, I've got an I, a C, actually I got two C's and a G. This tells you which of the reserve banks from which of the reserve banks this was printed, this originated, your money. So each of the banks serves as, the banking system serves as an agent for the Treasury to print the money. Now, not all of the money is actually physical money, but a lot of money is still printed that's physical. Now, physical money, just coins and currency alone, is what we call the base currency. We designate it as M0. M0, that's the base currency. It's just the hard cash and coins that are floating around out there in the world. M0. Now, above M0 is M1. This is M0 along with other highly liquid forms of money, including checking account, what we call demand deposits. If someone has a check, that person can go and demand immediate satisfaction of that check. That makes it a very liquid instrument. So putting M0 along with checking accounts, demand deposits, you get M1. Now above M1 is something that includes M1, but it also includes some more illiquid things. Things that aren't quite as easily changed into another asset. Now in M2 you would see some CDs, certificates of deposit. You would, a smaller one, smaller time deposit, some money market mutual fund stuff, money market stuff would be an M2. Also, now accounts. Do any of you have a checking account with a credit union by any chance? Okay, that actually is not a check. It's what's called a negotiable order of withdrawal. Technically, the bank doesn't have to satisfy it on demand immediately. They could wait. So, in a theoretical sense, you could actually not see that being all that liquid. It usually is. But now accounts, now money is in M2, not M1. Oh, I forgot, in M1, strangely enough, traveler's checks are in M1. They're not very common anymore, but they're still out there, and some people use them. I don't know if you've ever used traveler's checks, but they really are as good as money. And so you see, though, traveler, I forgot to mention that. In M1. So M1 has cash and currency, demand deposits, and traveler's checks. M2 has all of M1 and some somewhat less liquid stuff like money market mutual funds, smaller CDs, now accounts, negotiable order of withdrawal accounts. And then the big 800-pound gorilla is M3. M3 has M2. These are actually, each one's a bigger set holding the other ones in. M3 has M2, and it has these just enormous animals that you and I would not even recognize as money. You would have euro dollars in there, these massive CDs, and other stuff. And I that's my technical term, stuff. It's hard. You couldn't even see this. You cannot go. If you had, first of all, M3, if you're talking about something that's an M3 that's not M2, if you're talking about just pure M3, highly illiquid stuff, I mean, it doesn't even have a lot of times doesn't even have a physical existence. There's not something you could hold in your hand. You cannot drive into the drive-thru at Taco Hell and get something with M3 money. You can't do it. It's just that diffuse. It's not usable. This was the big critical problem that I was focusing on in the articles that I had you read, The Federal Reserve Under Fire. Did you see how M3 was growing like wildfire? The banks can't use that to pay bills. The banks can't use that to make loans. It's not money in a sense that is usable for normal transactions. That was why the banks were using this to back credit derivatives, because then they could sell the credit derivatives to suckers and they'd generate some real M1 kind of money they could use for things like loans, like paying their light bills and stuff like that. So that was one of the critical disasters that was looming. that we were, a few people, a few economists like me, we were screaming our brains out. Look, what's happening. Oh, there's nothing. Oh, don't see. So what did the Federal Reserve do because M3 was growing out of control? It stopped publishing M3. Yeah, that tells you they knew damn well that there was a problem building. How did they deal with it? They covered it up. That's bad for business. Enough of that. I feel that pain going up my left arm again. Okay, now, why am I bitching about the Fed and M3? Well, I mean, you're blaming the Fed. Do you have a reason to blame the Fed for this? Here are the three roles of the Federal Reserve. The first role of the Federal Reserve is that it supervises and regulates the banking system. The Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, that's seven people. That includes, by the way, the chairman, who is one of the seven. The chairman is one of the seven. Ben Bernanke is our current chairman. The Board of Governors supervises, and each of the member banks, the district reserve banks, they are the ones, I'm getting myself backwards here. The Board of Governors regulates. They create the banking regulations. That is their job. Then each of the district banks supervises the banks in its district, carrying out the will of the regulators at the board level. So the Board of Governors will create the regulations. It regulates. And then it is the responsibility of each of the reserve banks, the 12 reserve banks, to supervise its banks to make sure that they follow the regulations. Okay, you follow how it works. Now, the epicenter of the disaster in our financial system was in New York. So, who is now our Treasury Secretary? The former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. The bank that was at the epicenter, the bank that had the responsibility for the supervision of the New York banks. In fact, the Federal Reserve actually has offices in the big banks, in the big towers in New York. It actually has a permanent physical presence in some of those banks, in the big dog banks. It failed miserably, and now the guy who was in charge of that bank is our Treasury Secretary. Be afraid. Be very afraid. This is the Bank Federal Reserve's responsibility, is to supervise and to regulate. That's its job. And in the business world, you don't do your job. Don't point to someone else. Don't look around like everyone else wondering who farted. You did. Two, the Federal Reserve Bank is a bank for banks. It provides commercial services, but it does so in parallel competition with private banks that do the same thing. I mean, a bank has to have a bank to deposit its money in. A bank has to have a bank to clear its checks. Banks are just like any other business. They have to have a bank. The Federal Reserve is there to provide this. But it provides that service in direct head-to-head competition with private companies that do the same thing. Now, as I understand it, and I was just looking at the New York Fed's current numbers, it's saying that the Federal Reserve is right now providing about 35% to 40% of the commercial services to banks in the United States, which would mean that maybe around 60%, maybe 65% of the banking services for banks are provided by private commercial services that do this. Okay, so this is like the reason the Fed is in there is to foster competition and also to push new technology forward good and hard so that none of the other services that offer this can sit on their fat asses and just do a bad job. So the Federal Reserve is in there in direct competition with private businesses that provide the same commercial banking services for banks. Now, there's something funny about that. If you think about that, and I'm going to bring this up, I'm going to write a brief article about this. You know this talk about the health care reform and the public option, the government providing an option for health care insurance? You have this screaming, well, we can't have that kind of socialism. We're doing it in the banking system, and we've been doing it for almost a century, providing a public option for banks that want banking services. And it's a multi-billion dollar, it's tens of billions of dollars in value our government provides as a public option for banks. So when you hear this talk about, well, public option and healthcare, that's kind of like socialism, me. Well, we do this all the time for banks. We've been doing it for decades. It's the way we do it. And it actually, believe it or not, it works very well. Because the banking system, these commercial banks that provide banking services for banks, they provide decent fees. They provide very good, fast, efficient service. Hardly ever a mistake in the system. It's a very clean, smooth system. And part of that's because you have an 800-pound gorilla called the Federal Reserve Bank as one of the competitors that keeps the other ones honest and keeps the prices low in the market. So kind of keep that in mind when you hear the debate about socialism in healthcare, government providing a public option. We've been doing that for banks for years, for decades. Now, here's the big one. Monetary policy. The Federal Reserve conducts monetary policy. The Federal Reserve is responsible for the control of the money supply. No one else is. It's the Federal Reserve's job. There's always been a complaint by a certain libertarian / right-wing kind of group that says, well, the Constitution says that monetary policy is in the hands of Congress. Congress shall coin the currency or something like that. Well, yes, but this is a way. The theory was that if we take monetary policy and put it in the hands of an independent organization, as an independent central bank, that would take it out of the political realm so that we wouldn't have Congresses who just printed money whenever they wanted to spend their brains out. We separated the monetary policy from the political process by creating this Federal Reserve Bank to oversee monetary policy. And that would keep this out of the hands, keep money out of the hands of the greedy politicians. And that would ensure that the one and only one goal of monetary policy would be faithfully followed. And that one and only one goal of monetary policy is this: stability of the aggregate price level. Stability of the aggregate price level. In other words, we would not have inflations and we would not have deflations. We would not have inflations and we would not have deflations. We would ensure that we had an independent organization, an independent body, that would see to it that the money supply grew only at the real growth rate of the economy. As the economy needed more money, just enough more money would be provided by this independent bank. If the money supply grows faster than the real growth rate of the economy, the value of each dollar waters down. That's inflation. If the money supply grows more slowly than the real growth rate of the economy, each dollar would go up in value. That would be a deflation. We don't want those. Inflations and deflations are destabilizers of economic activity. Believe me, as finance people, we don't need the aggravation. When we have unpredictability of inflation, when we have inflation expectations that are getting bad, we don't like it. And another thing, too, is as bad as inflations are, Most economists and financial people I know would really love to stay on the other side of the universe from a deflation. We sure as hell don't want inflations, but God help us. We saw deflation in the Great Depression. It is quite awesome. Unfortunately, we had set up, if you look at the charts that I showed, gave you in the articles, the Federal Reserve Under Fire, you will see that the money supply, M1, the kind of money that businesses and households use and need, was most decidedly growing more slowly than the real growth rate of the economy from 2004 or so up until recently. That was setting up a deflation at the level of the households and the normal businesses. And sure as hell, we saw a few scary signs. If you look at this consumer price index over the last year or so, you saw deflation numbers. So it's theory and the observation matched. But at the top level, M2, M3, they were growing way too fast. So you also have extraordinary inflation pressures too. And what's the result of that? God only knows. Well, I do. But God might not, but I do. I will tell you, share that with you later. Monetary policy, the Federal Reserve. Now, let me emphasize this. The price of money is interest. More specifically, the rental rate of money is the interest rate. That is why I am bearing down on monetary policy, because monetary policy is to the direct effect of changing or maintaining an interest rate environment. If monetary policy goes out of whack, then interest rates begin to behave in rather odd ways. You can have nasty effects happen. So let me rock through this. Monetary policy, there are three tools of monetary policy in order of their commonality of use, in order of their power. The first one is that we have a fractional reserve banking system. So effectively, what we do is we require banks to keep a little bit of their money on deposit to satisfy demand for deposits. And then we allow the banks to lend out the rest. So let me show you what will happen. Suppose that we have a system where the banks are required to hold, let's say, a required reserve ratio of 20% of their funds. They have to hold 20% of their money in the vault. The rest they can lend out. Now, let's take something interesting here. You just get a check from Bill Gates for $1,000. He saw you walking down the street and he figured, you're an intelligent-looking man. I'll send you a check for $1,000. So you go to your friendly bank and you deposit that $1,000. Well, I am the banker. Why, thank you. So what I will do is I will follow my RRR and put in the vault $200. I'll put in the vault the required reserve of $200. But that means that I can lend $800. You come to me, you say, I should like to borrow $800 because I want to start my own business. Well, what kind of a business is it? Well, I was thinking of a Swedish massage parlor. And I said, indeed. What's it going to be called? Rolf's Massage Parlor. You're Rolf? No, I'll pretend I am. Okay. Can you fake a Swedish accent? Yes, I can. Okay, fine. I give you $800. Well, you, of course, you'll take that and you will hire you to build this parlor. Don't give me that look. You build things like this. Okay? And you get the $800 from him. You bring it to my bank to deposit it. Okay, sweet. I got another $800. So I take the 20% out of that. which would be 160, and I have 640. Whoops, I'm sorry, I'll put that 800 here. Is available. You come to me and you say, well, I should like to start my own grocery store. Really? Your own grocery store? What are you going to sell? Squid. Oh, God. Okay, fine. I shall lend you. How much do you need? $640? Well, you buy that. You get the $640. You have him build your $640 store, and he brings the money and deposits it into my bank. Look what's happening. The money supply is expanding. The money supply is growing. It started with $1,000, but after three rounds of this, we're already up to, what the hell are we up to? $2,440. This will just keep going. It's called the multiplier effect on money. How far does it go? Well, you could just do this all the way down to the pennies, but there's actually a little formula. The money multiplier is 1 over the required reserve ratio. So I know that the multiplier in this case is 1 over 0.20, which is 5. So my original deposit times 5 means that this $1,000 deposit created $5,000 of money. The Federal Reserve establishes the required reserve ratio. Notice that if the reserve ratio goes down, the multiplier goes up. If the reserve ratio goes up, the multiplier goes down. So the Fed has this club. It's actually a very blunt weapon, but it's a weapon for making money grow in the economy. If it boosts the required reserve ratio, it will slow down the growth of money because the multiplier will go down. But if it lowers the required reserve ratio, it will actually cause the money supply to grow more quickly. So this, and again, notice how this is like a blunt instrument. You can cause a lot of growth by just small changes in the money in the required reserve ratio. Now, the truth of the matter is that the ratio is actually a little more complex than just this 1 over RRR. You also have to take into account that people hold real cash balances. They don't take all of their money and put it into the bank, although they do a lot. But if you include the percentage that people don't put in the bank, that they keep in their pockets, the multiplier becomes a little more complex. It becomes 1 plus RRR. Over K plus RRR, where K is the percentage of money people keep in their pockets. And I'm not going to test you on that. Don't sweat that. But I do want to point out, just as a point of completeness, that the real money multiplier is this. So if people are holding, notice, interestingly enough, if people are, what am I doing? No, I 1 plus K. I'm sorry, it's 1 plus K on top. 1 plus K over K plus RRR. I can't talk and chew gum at the same time. But the thing, though, is that in bad times, people tend to hold more money in their pockets, especially if they're worried about the banking system. So you can see that that can blunt this tool of monetary policy. Realistically speaking, right now, I saw an estimate about a month ago. What is the actual money multiplier that is really going on right now? Strangely enough, it is actually fairly low. I believe it was something like 2.3. So the real world money multiplier, if you were to, when you calculate this thing the way it actually is right now from empirical data, the multiplier's power is at 2.3, a factor of 2.3, which is actually historically low. I mean, when I do these kinds of examples in class, I'm showing money multipliers of 10, 5, things like that. But in the real world right now, maybe 2.3. Very low multiplier effect. So the Fed's ability to grow the money supply through the required reserve ratio is not all that powerful. So the first tool of monetary policy is the required reserve ratio. Now, the second tool of monetary policy, even a couple of years ago, I would have said, this is really kind of a false tool. It's more like a symbolic tool. It's called the discount rate. When a bank wants to borrow money, the bank can go to two places. One, it can go to other banks to borrow. That's called the federal funds market. Or it can just go and borrow money from the Fed. At the Fed, they would go to what's called the discount window. I don't think there's really a window. I should like a loan. But the rate that the Fed would charge for a loan to a bank, that's called the discount rate. And the Fed publishes this rate. Now, historically, when the Federal Reserve publishes its discount rate, after its meeting, it's met, and well, we are going to hold the discount rate at, or we're going to raise the discount rate, or we're going to lower the discount rate. Mostly that was just a signal to the markets, this is the direction we want interest rates to go. This is the one we charge, but no one really goes to our window. Think about it this way. Do you have a father?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I want you to imagine, you've got a choice. You're really desperate for $500. You really need it. Which would you prefer to go to? A friend who would say, yeah, fine. Or go to your dad who would grill your ass, what the hell do you need $500 for?
I guess a friend.
Yeah, you see, historically, it's even though you would probably, your friend would charge you a higher interest rate, just like a bank would charge a bank a higher interest rate, you really would prefer to go to a friend than have to go home and go, you know, I have $500, I kind of like wrecked my car, or something like that, or something worse, you know, I got to pay, you know, I escaped from jail, so I got to go back and pay my bail bond now. You don't want to do that. You don't want to be grilled by the Fed. So historically, banks would prefer to go to the federal funds market to borrow money, even though the interest rate there, the Fed funds rate, is higher than the discount rate. Interestingly, though, the Fed has essentially opened up its doors. Come and borrow money from us. Banks have walked up the Fed has literally almost poured money out of the discount window into banks in recently. That's what some of this TARP and stuff you hear about. This is just a discount window open wide. Please borrow money from us. We won't charge you an interest rate. You're charging nothing? No. It's almost that bad. Okay, that's the discount rate. It's more, historically, it was like a signal. We're going to raise the discount rate. That told the financial markets, the investors, the capital markets, the financial planners, watch for interest rates to go up. This is what we want. Or if the Fed lowered the discount rate, that would tell the financial markets, okay, look for interest rates to start falling. Because that's what the Fed wants to happen. Now, whether it'll happen or not is driven by the third. But it was like a signal. Finally, is the biggie. The one that's done every day, right in front of everyone's noses. It's hiding in plain sight, an enormous ebb and flow of capital from what are called open market operations. OMOs. Open market operations are determined by the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC. Now, the FOMC comprises the seven governors and five bank presidents. Now, four of those bank presidents serve on a rotating basis. One of the bank presidents is a permanent voting member of the FOMC, the bank president of the New York Bank, the Empire Bank. He has a permanent seat. That would be Timothy Geithner before he became Treasury Secretary. The 12 voting members of the FOMC make decisions about draining and adding liquidity to the banking system through what are called the open market operations. Now, why is the New York Bank having a permanent seat when the other banks have rotating seats? I believe it's 2 years, rotating seats. It's because the Empire Bank is the location of what is called the domestic trading desk. trust me, we're getting to the end where the interest rates actually show up. But unfortunately, this is also where I have a very funny feeling that the economics behind it will be a little bit foggy to you. That's okay. I'm going to cover it here. Try to do it quickly before you think about it. Okay. Now, let us say that the FOMC has decided that more money should be in the banking system. Let's say we want to add liquidity to the banking system. Okay. Now, the FOMC would make its decision that the money supply is to expand. So, they would communicate this order to the domestic trading desk, which is at the New York Bank, New York Reserve Bank. Now, the manager at the desk is overseeing literally traders who have two things. Each trader will have a pile of money and a pile of U.S. Treasury bills. Now, banks can use money to make loans. Banks cannot use treasury bills to make loans. Either one, a bank will be okay with. They're both very liquid, very safe capital. So what the trader's job is to alter the balance of banks' portfolios of treasuries versus cash money. Now, we've got a bank here. Got a bank out here. Now, all of the banks are going to have their money in this ginormous pool we would call the federal funds market. This is the giant pool of money that banks have to use. Now, a bank is going to actually have a portfolio of dollars in its liquid, and it's going to have T-bills in its portfolio too. Any bank will have both of those. There will be a certain balance in its portfolio. Now, we're going to make you a trader, and I'm a bank, and I'm sitting here, I'm the president of the bank, and I've got me money on this side of me and treasury bills on this side. You want me to have more money. You want me to have more money. So which of these would you want from me? My dollars or my T-bills? You would offer to buy from me my T-bills. Because you'd give me money and I'd have more money and I'd have fewer T-bills. The balance of my portfolio would tip more towards liquidity of money. And then I'd have more money to lend. Okay, so now, she and all of these other traders are out there. She is trying to buy my T-bills. You want my T-bills. So that is a demand phenomenon. Okay, there's a supply. So what is happening with the price of T-bills is that I say, no, I don't want any. No, I don't want any of your money. But you say, but I want your T-bills. I'll pay you for them. How much will you pay me? $940, not good enough. What else would you pay me? $950, nah, $980, okay. By you trying to buy my T-bills and by all these other traders trying to buy my T-bills, you're pushing up the price of those T-bills, okay? Now, the other thing that's going to happen is that outside traders are going to say, whoa, the Fed's stepping in. I see the Fed making a move for liquidity. And if you heard that prices might go up because of what she's doing, you as a private trader might even jump in and start trying to buy T-bills to take advantage of the price increases that you could earn. So there's going to be secondary activity. But what's going to happen is that the price of T-bills is going to go from P1 to P2 as the Fed's traders at the desk buy in. That will push the price of T-bills up. Now, here comes the money shot. As the price of a T-bill rises, what happens to its yield? I was on the quiz, for God's sake. Yes. Her buying activity, all those traders' buying activity at the desk, that demand push is going to push the price of T-bills up, which will push the yields on T-bills down. Price of T-bills goes up, yield goes down. T-bills flow, as you buy them, T-bills flow to the Fed, and dollars that you buy them with flow to the bank, which then puts them into the federal funds market, more dollars. More dollars in the federal funds market. Let's say that this is the Fed funds market. This is lendable funds. This is what banks can use to lend money to people at interest rates. Here's the demand for loans. Here's the supply of loans. Here's the demand for lendable funds. There's the supply of lendable funds. As more and more money floods into the market, the supply of lendable money shoots outward, and interest rates at the level of the bank start sliding downward because the banks are swimming in more money so they can make more loans at lower interest rates. Complicated, ain't it? It happens every day, billions of dollars. This is how the Fed would add liquidity to the market. That's how the Fed would add liquidity to the market. That's how the Fed drives down interest rates. Has the Fed been doing this? Oh, yeah. The federal funds rate, which is the rate at which banks actually lend money to each other, and that's sort of like a base, and then they'd lend money to you and me at a little higher rate than that. The federal funds rate right now is somewhere between 0 and 0.5%. 0.5%, that's unbelievably low. How serious is it? If you get to the yields on T-bills, I have seen several actual real-world balance sheets at the end of a day where the yields on T-bills were negative. The price had gone up so much that the yields were actually negative. In other words, you were paying the government to lend it money. That is how severe the money flood is, simply to keep get interest rates down to boost the economy, to wake the economy up. Historically, there's data that indicates there were a couple of times during the Great Depression when the Fed had pushed interest rates negative. But really, almost never, certainly in my lifetime, did I think I would ever see negative interest rates. I have seen T-bill calculations where at the end of the day there were traders scrambling, private traders for companies, scrambling to buy some T-bills to balance their books at the end of the night. They finally found some at ridiculously high prices at near the end of the day. They bought them up. Then they ran the calculations. One lady, she was a former student of mine, actually asked me to look. She said, is this right? Negative 0.47% on the yield. Negative 0.47%, that's a negative yield on a T-bill. And that was purely because of this powerful flood of traders hammering banks, buying their T-bills, soaking up the T-bills, driving up the prices, driving down the yields. That's open market operations adding liquidity on crack. But it happened. It's wonderful because it's almost like magnified now to the point where I can tell stories like this. In more normal times, these are subtle nuances, you know, ebbs and flows. It used to be that the Fed actually would try to play games. 2 days they'd add liquidity, then another day they'd drain liquidity. They play it back and forth just to try to confuse the traders. Go ahead.
Well, what are they using to buy the T-bills then? They're using
money. Literally money that they print. That's what's really fascinating about it is these might have actually come, well, actually they probably did come in a sense from an open market operation. If I've had one that was new, most of mine are kind of chewy. If I had one that was new, I could tell you right now, yeah, that was from an OMO that happened very recently. Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because literally, when I said that you have a portfolio of cash, when you finally sold me, let's say at 980 on a T-bill, there was a credit and a debit thing. You know, you've got this much money in your federal funds account, cha-ching. But at some point, the bank might say, that's nice, the electronic stuff, but could I have the cash because there's this guy who wants his money over here? you would actually truck me the money. Under armed guard, of course. Don't try to steal from those trucks. Those guys can't carry really cool weapons. But you would literally, at some point, now you wouldn't be in charge of that part, but if I'm the banker, I'd say, you know, I've got this money that you say I've got. Can I have, like, you know, the crinkly stuff for it? And it would, that would be, there would be a direct connection between what had happened there and the money that would eventually show up at the bank, probably. So, yeah, I'm glad you asked that, though. It's real money. Now, the other side of it, sooner or later, this is going to come to a bad end. Because if the money supply grows at a rate faster than the real growth rate of an economy, sooner or later, you will get inflation. Worse yet, you will get expected inflation if it doesn't stop. Because eventually, the people, the banks and the businesses are going to say, FTS. Fancy that scenario. They're going to say, this money is not backed by anything. This is watered down money. This is, to put it politely, this is shoot. Not the right vowel, I know, but it's, and eventually that money will water down and prices will start to rise. That's bad enough. But what's even worse, and I said this before, and I'll just say it, repeat it one more time, it's not the prices rising. It's when people and businesses believe that they will keep rising. Because then, when the Fed does get religion, when it finds Jesus, no one believes them. So the Fed starts to pull back on the money supply, but expected inflation stays high while real interest rates are rising at the same time. You get the classic makings of a killer recession because you've got two things pushing interest rates up. Expected inflation and then the Fed's sudden dedication to contractionary monetary policy. Let me show you contractionary monetary policy. It will happen. Sooner or later, even a wuss like Ben Bernanke is going to have to find religion and do this. The federal funds market is just swimming in money. As a matter of fact, banks are trying to give the Fed back money from some of these stimulus programs. We don't want it. Banks are being pissy now. Well, we don't like to lend to anyone but perfect credit. So they're trying to give it back. The federal funds market is just swimming in M1 money now. If you look at the numbers recently, and I will be publishing the numbers recently, the Fed, if you look at M3, suddenly M3 is tailing downward, finally. You have to use private services. You can't get the M3 from the feds. And you notice M1 is just skyrocketing now. Well, isn't that nice? Now you're trying to save it. Instead of controlling the money supply properly on a day-to-day basis, year over year, now suddenly you're scared crapless and you're growing M1 way too fast, trying to save the situation. And what are they doing with that M1 money? They're stepping up to the Treasury auctions and buying the government's debt instruments. Essentially, now the Fed is just printing money hand over fist to lend to provide the government with the money for its massive budget deficits. But here we go. Sooner or later, contractionary monetary policy. The domestic trading desk, again, is where the action starts. From the orders of the FOMC. The FOMC says we are going to pursue contractionary monetary policy, therefore drain liquidity like there's no tomorrow. Well, in this case, here is the bank again. And again, it will have a portfolio. That portfolio will include dollars and T-bills, both of which are very safe, tier one. They're both liquid. It's just that the one of them can't be used for loans. The other one can. The dollars can be used for loans. The T-bills can't be. But they still establish strength in the bank. Even the T-bills do. Okay, so now we've got you again. And again, you have a pile of money and you have a pile of treasuries that you can use for your work. Now here I am, the banker. I've got tons of money now and I've got some treasury bills. Well, where's the bank getting the treasury bills? Well, the bank's running to the auctions, the treasury auctions, and buying them up with the money the Fed's giving it. So the banks are making a profit from the gain on the liquidity side. But anyway, you come to, well, now I want to I want to sell you some treasury bills. I want to sell you some treasury bills. Well, why do you want to sell me treasury bills? Because I want you to pay me with your money so you don't have as much money. Wait a minute, a while back, you wanted to buy my treasury bills to give me money. Well, that was then. This is now. Now I want to sell you some of my treasury bills because you'll pay me with money and that will take money out of your banking account in the federal funds market. Okay, so she is going to try to drain my liquidity. So here we go. Well, you want to sell me some treasury bills. Isn't that nice? What price? Oh, $980? Kiss my ass. I don't want your damn stuff. That's expensive. $960? No. $940? See how she has to bid down? She's trying to flood the market with T-bills. She's trying to flood them. She's trying to wait. You got all this crap. I've heard you're calling everyone trying to sell T-bills. Your supply of T-bills, the supply of T-bills in the global market is just going crazy right now. Why the hell should I pay $950? Okay, fine, $900. What's happening here is that she is trying to sell me T-bills to draw money out, which means in this case, if I were to talk about the T-bill market against the price of T-bills, what she is trying to do is flood the market with the supply. As the supply of T-bills increases, flooding the market, we're going, as the bankers, we're going to bid those mofos down. 900, try 880, try 870. See how the price is going down, P2? Okay, so she's draining the liquidity, she's pulling liquidity out, feeding T-bills in, which I can't use to lend. Okay, the price of T-bills is going down. If the price of T-bills goes down, what does that do to the yield on T-bills? I love it when you talk like that. Spank me, Jesus. Look at that. The price of T-bills is being driven down because the domestic trading desk is flooding the market with them. The domestic trading desk is just dumping these. And so what that will do is that will drive the price of T-bills down, which will drive the yields on them up. So we've got the yields on T-bills will start to skyrocket. Now, here's the other thing. All of that money that was in the federal funds, I got to pay you. Oh, fine, you want to be paid? Well, la-dee-da. So I pay the desk from my federal funds. That takes federal funds out of the lendable funds market. This is the lendable funds market again. Now, suddenly, we've got supply and demand. There was an interest rate in the market, but now the supply of lendable funds has contracted. That will drive the interest rates on lendable funds up. The federal funds rate, the rate at which I lend to other banks, will go up, and so all rates to lend to businesses and to people will begin to rise as well. So the double whammy on the other side, draining the liquidity causes T-bill yields to rise, and it also causes the rates at the federal funds rate level and at the rate level of consumer and business loans to start to go up. And that would be contractionary monetary policy. That's what will eventually happen. It has to happen. And at that time, what we hope to God is that the economy is underway strong enough to be able to sustain a rising interest rate environment. If this begins to happen too soon, we'll kill off our recovery before it even barely gets off the ground. So the Federal Reserve's trick is that it's got to keep pouring the money in, knowing that it's going to cause inflation down the road, but know when to pull the brakes on at just the right time, once the economy is underway and moving again, and how the economy is underway and moving again strong enough that it can sustain the higher interest rate environment as the Federal Reserve begins to drain the liquidity out that has been building for the past 5 years. Actually, it's been building for the past 9 years. And by the time the Fed does this, for the past 10, 12 years. Bad news ahead. Yes. Is the Fed able to do this? I don't think so. Some economists say, yeah, but it's going to take real mastery. And that's why I say it ain't going to happen. We'll see, though. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.